Creativity without a way of putting it into practice or making it into something, they're just ideas. You know, you have to have a diverse group of people to actually go, that's brilliant, I understand it. Let's challenge that, let's add to it, let's take away, and let's put that through and actually make it into something.
Today on Dirty Linen, we are heading all the way to the other side of the world, to the UK. We are talking to Ashley Palmer-Watts, who has spent a lot of time in Australia as the head chef or executive chef of Dinner by Heston with Heston Blumenthal. But he is back in the UK now as the UK is reopening again after a bit of a lockdown. Ash, welcome to Dirty Linen. Great to have you on the show.
Thank you. How are you?
Oh, well, we're in another little lockdown, so I'm fine. I'm fine. But I wish we weren't. And yeah, I'm just hoping that we can smash this one as we have before and get back out there eating and enjoying restaurants. Tell me what things are like in the UK at the moment.
Well, restaurants opened sort of probably, 2 months ago. They reopened outside only, which was difficult for some. Others found it a little bit more easy. They had gardens and sort of places outside the restaurant, and especially in London, they closed a lot of the roads so that, you know, they could put tables and chairs out, which was quite, you know, it was great spirit and everyone got behind it. So, but now restaurants are open inside, which is good. Still social distancing, masks when you're walking around, et cetera, et cetera. But I mean, it's got off to an absolute flyer. I think the support for the restaurants has been amazing. It's going to take a long time to get back to where it was before. But hopefully, like you say, hopefully we don't get back in another lockdown or further restrictions. But so far, so good. Fingers crossed.
Well, I remember, you know, this time last year, England was reopening. There was the Eat Out to Help Out incentives for people to get back to restaurants. It all seemed, you know, like an exciting summer, but then things went a little bit off the road. I mean, I guess there's a big difference this year in that so much of the population is vaccinated. But how do you think people are feeling about reopening? Are people tentative or are they trusting it this time?
Well, I think a lot of people, you know, from my experience of talking to them, is they have to open and they have to get back, and they just hope that they can trade at a level that is going to sort of allow them to claw back some of the huge losses that were had. And I mean, our biggest problem here is staff. Every single person I know in a restaurant needs staff, and they are so desperate, front and back. We're slightly different here in the sense of when we locked down again, you know, of course, our borders were open and we had a lot of travel through Europe. So hence we got ourselves in a bit of a mess here, whereas you guys just shut everything down, which I think is, you know, absolutely brilliant that you can do that. And so now everyone, a lot of the Europeans, the French, Italians, Spanish, Polish, you know, Eastern Europeans all went home because obviously living here is so expensive, especially in London. And then now with Brexit, they've changed the visa law. So now you need to sponsor in the same sort of manner as you do in Australia. So, of course, it's not as that easy to get people back into the country. And I think we're probably about 200,000 people short at the moment in hospitality.
Wow. I mean, that is amazing. And you would well know from your time in Australia that we rely heavily on people from overseas to staff restaurants. Everyone here is struggling for staff as well for some of the same reasons. People weren't assisted through the pandemic in Australia, and a lot of them went back to their countries of origin. And yeah, they can't get back here either, not because of Brexit, but because Australia's borders are still closed and it's hard for a lot of citizens to get back, let alone people who don't have Australian passports. But yeah, it's so massive to think of the UK going through Brexit at the same time as going through a pandemic.
Well, I think, you know, that was... The reality of that has been sort of bumbling along you know, with price rises, shipping difficulties, you know, trade agreements and so on and so forth. I mean, I remember a year and probably a year and a half ago, there was a lot of fuss about being able to fly, you know, because they didn't have an agreement in place for the airlines to, you know, land in these other countries. And, you know, it just wasn't really well thought through. But when you put it up against, you know, the sort of catastrophe of COVID, it kind of got overshadowed, really. And now the reality is starting to bite in. And I think, you know, that you've got that very old fashioned view that, you know, we want to give jobs to all the English people and, you know, and not anyone else first. And, you know, and the reality is that the world isn't like this anymore. You know, it's a multicultural world, and hospitality is made up of all brilliant people from all over the world. And now when restaurants and bars and pubs and cafes can actually, you know, literally open the doors and try and regain some of that business, they're having to limit themselves because they're just so short-staffed, you know? Oh, God. Hold on, sorry.
That's all right.
Oh, man. How do I shut that up? There we are. Sorry about that. I didn't turn that one off.
That's all right. I mean, there are so many similar kinds of conversations being had here, Ash, about staffing and people who I suppose aren't as involved in the industry also sometimes have that view. Well, just train up locals, just get locals in the business. Aren't there people unemployed? Why don't they work in restaurants? And of course, you know, to some degree, like there are people grabbing, you know, young Aussie kids and training them up and getting them in and I suppose accommodating that in various ways, whether it's simplifying ordering systems or restricting menus. I mean, are those the kinds of things that people are talking about there?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of what we found here is that a lot of people, I mean, our government have been pretty good in terms of supporting the staff and, you know, with the furlough scheme and things like that. Been a little bit more tricky for the actual businesses themselves, and it's almost they've had to fend for themselves with their landlords and manage costs, etc. that way. But I think a lot of people now have really, I mean, we've been in lockdown a long time over the two periods, and I think a lot of people have sort of realized that actually they don't want to work so many hours, and they don't want to work on the weekends, and they don't want to miss out on what everyday life is now like, because a lot of people in hospitality have only experienced normal working life as a child, really, pre-work, because if you went straight into hospitality, that's all you know. So I think a lot of people have said, well, actually, I'm not coming back, and I'm going to retrain as this, or I'm going to try and start my own little business over here. So it's twofold, really. It's lost a bit of shine off the industry itself and the prospects. But then on the flip side, I think from a customer point of view, I think that people have never been more receptive and appreciative of what the experience of going out, whether it's at a level of, you know, $500 a head or $15 a head, you know, or a cup of coffee or a pint of beer in a beer garden. They're so much more appreciative now than before.
It must be so frustrating for businesses to not be able to meet that demand and desire to go out to eat and drink if they don't have the staff to service it.
Yeah, 100%. And then the other thing is that because we were just opening up in this country, no staff are moving from their current positions. So if you moved now and then we went back into another lockdown, the support you might get might not be there because you've just changed jobs and, you know, you haven't been in employment for very long. So I think it'll start to open up a little bit more as restaurants are now, you know, sort of surviving and opening up. People will start to move. It'll start to generate some movement, and hopefully we can sort of bring some people back to the country from abroad, because I mean they're in a far worse position than we are here. France and Italy and Spain, it's pretty bad.
So yeah, you think there'd be a lot of people who had worked in the UK who would love to come back if they could?
I think so, because I mean, you know, COVID is just decimating businesses and restaurants. They're closing left, right, and centre. Even here, you know, they predict that sort of come January, February time, when it is this is always the tough trading months here because it's so cold. It's always really miserable. It's after Christmas. You know, January, February, March is a tough period. You know, that's when I think we're going to lose quite a few more successful restaurants, really.
It's really sad. So, I mean, interestingly, you're not involved in restaurants day to day at the moment after so many years of being at the helm of some of, you know, the world's best known restaurants. Tell me about what you've been doing since Dinner by Heston closed and you left the Fat Duck Group.
Yeah, so I left to open my own restaurant, and then COVID came along. So that kind of has kind of put a year and a half almost in between leaving and almost picking back up again. So I'm working on my own place, which is really, really exciting, which is what I left to do. And I had some other sort of avenues I wanted to go down as well. So the one we've just launched at the moment is a coffee company called Artisan Coffee Co., which is sort of coffee for everyone at home. And, you know, being fortunate enough to spend a lot of time in Melbourne where, you know, coffee is just, for me, it's the best I've ever experienced in the world. I've never experienced anything so far in front of anywhere else. That certainly that I've experienced on my travels. So I've had a great interest in coffee for a long, long time, but actually it ties back into our restaurant world where, you know, when a sommelier comes to the table with a massive wine list and they put it down, and for a lot of people, that's a very intimidating process. You know, the barriers go up and they think, oh, I don't know enough about wine, and I feel stupid. I feel out of my comfort zone and I don't know what I'm talking about. And over here, it's very much like that on the whole. You know, you've got the top end roasteries and sort of pioneers in the coffee business, but actually the people at home get very intimidated by sort of expert communication and terms and terminology that put those barriers up. So I thought it was a great opportunity to actually talk to people in a way where they can relate to it about taste and flavor and character and how things are going to be perceived and how to taste, and use my sort of upbringing in Bray with Heston to sort of bring a different view to it and communicate in a different way, but actually bring really characterful coffee to people at home. If they buy ground coffee from the supermarket, or it's pods, or it's whole bean, or it's for their mocha pot, you know, we will finely tune those blends for those brew types. So been working really hard on that. And what's the other one I've been doing? Oh, the other business we've set up is one called Le Blanc, which is a cycling and gastronomy events company. And this actually came about from the Margaret River Gourmet Escape events that we used to go to over there. And I used to speak to a guy who used to be one of the organizers, and I told him that I brought my bike, and he just couldn't believe it that I brought all my bike all the way to Western Australia. And he said, "Do you know what? I used to be a pro rider." And I said, "Really? I didn't know that." And he said, "Do you know what? We should do something about cycling and gastronomy." And so we set up Le Blanc, where it's Justin, myself as the culinary director, and then we have an ex-pro cyclist called Sean Yates, who he's pretty much been the director sportif and training team post his pro riding career for everyone from Bradley Wiggins, Team Sky, British Cycling. So between the three of us, we pull in great riders, legendary, and great chefs, and we have like these great weekends of brilliant riding with your peers, your heroes, great food and wine, stories from the saddle, from the kitchen, and just have a great time, really. So we've just had our first small event, and then we've got two events this year, one in Champagne with Eddie Merckx and Raymond Blanc, and then our second one in the Isle of Wight with Sir Bradley Wiggins and Claude Bossy.
Oh my God, that sounds so fun. And so do you, when you say you're culinary director, obviously you're partnering up with some great chefs along the way. Is that, I mean, is the food in local restaurants or is it like cooking in a field? I mean, what's the food side of it?
They all vary. I mean, the one in Champagne, we've taken over a hotel, beautiful hotel. And then Isle of Wight, again, we've taken over another hotel on the south of the island. So we use the kitchens there and outside dining. And then actually one I forgot that I'm actually doing at the end of July is up in Perthshire. And it's Sir Chris Hoy and myself. And that's a really intimate one of 20 guests for the weekend. We've taken over this stunning house, beautiful sort of terrace in the valleys in Perthshire, local produce. We also do sort of a time and a place dinner on the Friday night. So we bring in local chefs, a combination of to show their restaurants off, but also to show the local ingredients of the area and stuff. And then the Saturday is when it's the big 7-course dinner, either in the hotel, the house, or the or outside. Could be anywhere.
Wow. I mean, I love the sound of it. But I think what I love most about it is that it makes me feel hopeful about travel again, and that actually it is going to be possible to have amazing travel and food experiences at some point. We feel very locked in Australia at the moment, I have to say.
Yeah, I mean, it's been a long time. I mean, we've been moving events for the last, 15 months. And but the sort of engagement and the hunger for these type of experiences. And I think that's that, we have to look at the positive of obviously a really terrible time. And that is that people want, they see the value in the experience, not just the material things anymore. And I think the experience side of going to your favorite restaurant, or sitting down with friends that you haven't seen for a long time, and you tell someone you can't see people, or you can't touch them or hug them, or you can't go out walking with them, there's nothing more you want to do than do those things. So there is a big positive here, and I think it is a good thing for restaurants, in the sense that appreciation, it was all too easy before, and people, a lot of people wouldn't appreciate what goes in to pulling off those experiences for people. As simple as a cafe, people work so hard to do that, to give people great service, great food in whatever kind of level of experience that is. But now I think people, they're going to have a greater appreciation, and that can only help with the longer term view of actually career choice, because the appreciation is there, then you feel valued as well.
Yeah, well, I mean, I really hope it does have that follow through. I mean, it's something I've been thinking a lot about here, because if you value an experience, well, let me start again. I think restaurant meals in Australia, at least, have been very undervalued. Like, people should be paying more for those experiences. And if they value them more, perhaps they will be willing to. I don't know. What do you think about that? Do you think that sort of price parity has been easier to find in Europe?
Yeah, I mean, well, I would say here, I mean, the cost is going up, by the week, because there's obviously the post-COVID cost to every business, but there's also, the cost of actually sort of making sure that you've got enough time and you've got enough people and you're doing the right things, that actually people are going to have to pay more for what they experienced before. But I think it's even more so now that you've really got to deliver whatever level that is. It's got to be, best in class almost, where, it does tend to feel a little bit undervalued in some areas, where people, will have, will say, oh God, that's expensive. And you're like, well, how much do you think it costs to actually produce that? And it's only a good thing. Awareness with the right communication will do that for sure. But I mean, I think, certainly from my experience in Australia is, people just love going out, and the vibe is just so, that will come back for sure. I mean, no doubt. I mean, keeping everyone at home in Melbourne is going to be like unlocking sort of caged animals, you know, from not going out for a while, isn't it? It's just part of the lifestyle, isn't it? You guys live outside, you eat and drink outside. It's the way of life there.
Yeah, definitely. We certainly do love our restaurants. So, Ash, did you dodge a bullet by not having your restaurant open before March 2020?
Definitely. But I have, you know, I mean, it's been really, you know, it's like everyone. You have good days and you have bad days. And on the bad days, you know, I sit in my summer house office and I'm working on some great projects. But I really miss the, and it sounds really strange, I miss being so in it, you know, because a restaurant is a way of life. It's not a job, you know, and I felt some days you feel really guilty that you're out of it and you're not experiencing it, you know, as everyone is going through it. But certainly I've been trying to help my friends and sort of people I've worked with over the years to, you know, just for them to rant at me on the phone, you know, just I can take a slightly different view because I'm not in it myself, and try and think of a way and try and help sort of help them find their answers themselves to something that we might not have thought of before. You know, we've had to be really creative in this country to get through this because, you know, we've been in lockdown for months and months and months, and then we were out and then we were back in it, and literally we just come out of it. So, you know, it's been difficult, but yeah, I'm glad. I mean, if I'd opened a restaurant now, I'm not sure it would be that open because I wouldn't have generated the funds. I probably wouldn't have qualified for the government support either. So, incredibly lucky on that front.
And you mentioned that, you know, a lot of people have seen a taste of civilian life. They've seen their families, you know, for the first time in daylight. And perhaps some people have got a taste for that more balanced lifestyle. What about yourself? I mean, you've obviously spent heaps of time away from your family back and forth to Australia. What do you think about, you know, hanging on to some of that work-life balance?
Yeah, I think I think it's made everyone, especially myself, look at how when I do open my restaurants, how I can incorporate some of that into, you know, taking a clean view at things and having been out of it for, you know, definitely I won't open anything this year. So we're looking at spring next year. So, you know, 2 years out gives you a really fresh approach and you can sort of build how we may approach things differently, set things up differently, actually allow us to be able to take a new sort of generation forward. You know, some things are going to work and some things aren't and we'll need adjusting. But I think unless you push the thinking behind it, then you're never going to really change much, if that makes sense. So, you know, it's what I do, and unfortunately restaurants are open at night and it's when people want to go out and it's Saturday and Friday. It's the choice we all make, you know. That will never change. Weekends are the popular ones.
So what kind of brainwaves have you had about, you know, where do you think you can make changes?
Well, I think it's about structuring it so that definitely over here, over the past, I'd say past 5 years even. I mean, I don't live in a city. I live on the edge of a small town, and hopefully the restaurant I'm going to open is not in London. It's going to be out in the country. And, you know, people eat a lot earlier here, you know, and the health benefits of not eating so late, you know, because we're not in a big city. There aren't bars open and things like that. And so just sort of actually restructuring it and propositioning how you can open a little bit earlier, close a little bit earlier, but be really efficient with people's time, I think is key. And just making sure that the business model works, open and close periods with the amount of staff, giving them the right amount of time off, and so that they feel they've got a life. And I think if I could have worked a 4-day week, I mean, that would be absolutely incredible. But I know, you know, from non-restaurant people here, you know, people that live in my street, you know, they'll only be traveling to London 2 days a week now, three maximum. instead of five. So everyone's going through this massive work-life balance. And at the beginning of COVID and throughout COVID, everyone's like, oh, you know, the offices are now closed. We're going to get rid of our office. But, that's not going to happen so much. It'll be a downsizing. It'll be a partial working week in the office. I think I read yesterday Apple are demanding that all staff are back in September working in the office, minimum 3 to 4 days a week. So, you know, that interaction is really, really important from a creative point of view as well. So, you know, it's just a massive sort of moving feast of adjustment, really.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it is an opportunity to really rethink everything, as you say. I mean, when you think about the restaurant that you're going to open, Ash, like what aspects of your time with Heston will you take into it? What will be different?
Well, all of it, really. I mean, I've done a lot of talking about the coffee, and whilst I'm not from the world of coffee, I've used my 20 years upbringing of looking at things in a different way, and just not for the sake of it, but actually just looking at it, analyzing it, and saying, well, why do we do it like that? Why is it done like that? And can we do it like this? What would happen if we do this? And then sort of follow that through. So I think restaurant wise, I mean, it's quite a diverse, I can't really say much about it, but it's quite a diverse collection of experiences in one place. But I'm not going to be opening something that's aiming for 3 Michelin stars and liquid nitrogen and dry ice. That's not probably the food that I'm going to be cooking, you know, at my next place. But it will take shape. You know, I have a good idea of what it is, but it's I don't know, until you really start getting it under the skin of it and it starts gaining momentum, then it's just, I want people to come and have an experience that they can come and have 8 times a year, not be a bucket list restaurant. That's really important for me. And I think there's always a way of bringing aspirational things into sort of dining that you can come and experience 8 times a year. You know, might be more for some people, might be less, but I just want it to be really comfortable and just friendly, comfortable, casual, but actually the execution and the vibe of the place will be exceptional.
Ash, obviously, you know, working with Heston you were with Heston for a lot of years, and it must have been such an intense creative whirlwind. Can you tell us what it was like to work with Heston Blumenthal?
Yeah, I mean, I worked with him for over 20 years, and you know, we had the best 20 years, of my life, really. And you know, from the day I started, there were 5 in the kitchen. You know, when I wrote to him for a job, I actually went for a stage first, and then I wrote to him and said, look, this is the only place I want to work. You know, I came home one night from the restaurant I was working at, and my dad had left a note on my bed saying, check the, it's when we had answer phones at home, check the answer phone, Heston's left you a message. And so that's when the journey started. And so, you know, started, and this guy was just crusading his way in the food scene in this country. And at that time, literally, if you were right at the top of like the foodie niche market, you might have heard of Heston, but no one else had. And you say, oh, I'm going to work at the Fat Duck. Well, I've never heard of it. It was for a bloke called Heston, never heard of him, you know. And it was those days, and we started off, we had a la carte and a lunch menu, and then renovated in 2001, came back with a tasting menu, and that's when it really all started to kick off with working with different scientists and colleges, universities, libraries, you know, brain surgeons, psychologists, artists, musicians, you know, the whole thing. I mean, it was just, when I look back on it, it was the most incredible 20 years. And, you know, like I used to say to my team at dinner, I think we spent our time looking back in history and reading about people that were doing things that were worthy of writing about back, you know, 500-600 years ago. And I said, you know what, we'll be reading, well, we won't be, but people will still be reading about Heston in 500 years, you know, and that's how important the sort of, you know, the moments of pushing boundaries and breaking boundaries, it's really slowed down because there aren't the boundaries to break so much anymore. There's only so many you can make, in the same way that you can only make a car go so fast or accelerate so fast. You can't. There's certain things you get to a window or a ceiling, and those boundaries sort of, and also food, the interest in food and the trend of how people cook and stuff changes as well. But I mean, it was incredible. We traveled the world, we worked and met with the most incredible people. It was incredibly intense, so difficult at times, but you know, I wouldn't change it for anything, to be honest. And I think it's given me a really sort of a different view about how to go about things. And I've completely enjoyed sort of applying that 20 years knowledge. And some of it is not knowledge, it's just the actual confidence to say, well, actually, well, why are we doing it like that? Why do you do it like that? That doesn't make sense. Let's find out why. And let's find out if we change this, this, and this, what happens, and bring that innovation in and not be afraid to try, you know. And I think that's a really, really important attribute that I think, you know, but, I mean, there were times where you would do stuff, and, you know, when we got the third star, for example, in Bray, I remember Heston phoning up and saying, yes, it's, he was away at the time in Spain, and he got the confirmation from the Michelin guide, and he phoned up and answered the phone, and he said, yeah, we've got it, but we need to get better. And that sums it up, really. Like, you know, you get to the finish line, and then the finish line moves, and you're just like, right, yeah, but we've got to do it again, and we've got to be better, and we've got to be faster, and there must be a way we can do this. So it's that just relentless sort of pursuit to make things better was, yeah, just incredible, really.
Wow, it's amazing. I mean, I've chatted to Heston a few times, and obviously, you know, I don't know him anywhere near as well as you do, but his mind seems to go in 1,000 directions at once. It was sort of hard to grasp his train of thought at times. You seem much more, I guess, direct and considered, and perhaps, I don't know, like that you can hold on to an idea and be more methodical. I mean, is that a reasonable characterization of the way that you guys work together?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think it is important to say as well that everyone talks about the team, but, you know, it really was about the team. It was about understanding that a diversity in a team, you know, to give you an example, we worked with a sports performance coach and within our teams, because it actually highlighted the benefits of having a highly diverse, very flexible team that bounced off each other rather than a group of like-minded, similar people. You know, because one of the old school approaches with kitchens and restaurants is, right, why can't this person just be like me and do it like me? You know, that's built into the industry, really. But actually, you want diversity. But when you've got brilliant people, and if I look back at, say, between, let's say, 2002 and 2008, the collective between myself James Petrie, the pastry chef at the time, Kyle Connaughton, who's now got his 3-star in Napa Valley. Forget the name. It'll come to me. Chris Young used to be in our lab, who went on to do the modernist cuisine, and he's set up a couple of very innovative products post his time at the Duck. And then there's Lars Williams, who's Empirical Spirits. He was in the lab at the time. You know, we have people like Josh Nyland come through the lab. You know, he spent 3 months with us. And, you know, when you've got this constant sort of evolution of brilliant people coming through, when that all joins together with the right, let's say, structure, the methodicalness, but actually creativity without a way of putting it into practice or making it into something is just, they're just ideas. You know, you have to have a diverse group of people to actually go, that's brilliant, I understand it, let's challenge that, let's add to it, let's take away, and let's put that through and actually make it into something. So, you know, Bray was and still is a collection of just incredibly talented people at different times in their career. You know, some were older, some were younger, but it all accumulated in a thing that was a greater sum of its parts, I believe.
I mean, it makes me think of, you know, an exceptional sporting team. We just have those seasons that just gel. Like, it is just so much greater than the sum of its parts. It's that ineffable magic, like, but it's really interesting. Well, yeah, you worked with a sports psychologist. It's so interesting to think about all the strategy that must go into creating a team like that deliberately. I mean, what kinds of things will you take forward from that when you hire your own teams?
I mean, you know, it's been something that I've sort of incorporated for many years, is just having that diversity and character as well. You obviously, you don't know fully until people actually start working how they're going to pan out. But I think it's just having people with the right ethos and the right attitude towards wanting to give someone or make something better. Being open to, you know, constructive criticism, or being their own best critic or their own worst critic. You know, if you can look at your own work and go, "Joe, I could have done that better," that's what I want. You know, that's the kind of pursuit of excellence in everything we do. But also just be a nice person. You know, you don't need to be, you know, the old school mentality in a kitchen. You know, we don't need to, you know, feel like we're suffering all the time. We need to think outside the box and, you know, be smart, work smart, but just be nice as well.
Yeah, that doesn't sound too radical, and yet in a way it is quite radical.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's a very pressured environment. I mean, you know, when you explain to people about restaurants, if you look at a football, I can't remember how long an Aussie Rules football match goes on for, but is it 90 minutes or something?
Well, it's quarters, 25-minute quarters.
Okay. So, you know, you've got that intense sort of those quarters of intense work rate, you know, which is our service. But of course the services go on twice a day, pretty much, for 4 hours at a time, and then you've got your preparation, which is like your training. So the time in which people are on their A game in a restaurant, in a kitchen, or on the floor, you know, is a huge portion of their work time, you know, as opposed to other high performing things like, I don't know, Formula One or football match or a tennis player. You know, that concentration and that sort of attention to detail takes massive, massive concentration. So, you know, it's about working smart, really. But, I mean, and you've got to enjoy it. I just want people that want to do it for the right reason and have a good time at the same time. And that's been our ethos at the Duck for years and years.
You know, Ash, it also makes me think about every now and again on your Instagram, a post with your son pops up, who's who's studying ballet. I mean, that's another arena which is really intense. There's these, you know, performances, but a lot of work that goes into making those performances. Can you tell us about him and about how you sort of look at that very different field of dance in relation to what you do?
Yeah, so he started doing ballet when he was four, and literally we just let our kids try anything that they want to try, to be honest, and just find their way. And we're not like pushy parents in that way, where, you know, it's a case of, you know, you must do this, you must do that. If you don't want to do it, don't do it. But he kind of, I remember Emma coming back when he was probably about six going, do you know what, it's actually pretty good. And then, you know, about a year later, it's like, do you know what, he's actually got something here, but we need to move him into a different class because he's dancing with loads of girls and he's the only boy, so he's not a focal point. Moved him, was doing really, really well, and then again sort of, we need to move him to another school. Moved him to school. The lady came out and she just said, oh my God, I've not had a boy come along like this for a long, long, long time.
Wow.
He's got it.
Oh,
you should try him out. You should try him out for the Royal Ballet. And Emma called me and I was like, really? I was like, well, okay, well, you know, so Emma took him up to the Royal Ballet auditions, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, got into the junior associate. So he's been training up there for the last year and a half, 2 years on a Saturday at the Royal Ballet. It's just off the Royal Opera House across the street. And been doing really well. And then he has his local school. He has another coach in London. And then when lockdown happened, everything went online, which you would think, oh, this is going to be an absolute nightmare. But he actually danced probably 2.5-3 hours a day. Doing the most incredible classes with principal dancers from the Royal Ballet, from Tring, from all over. And the kind of, it was brilliant to see another industry that actually said, do you know what, we're all in this. We're going to open ourselves up. It's, you know, it's £5 for a masterclass lesson for 2 hours with like the most incredible principal dancers and these special sort of focused classes, as well as his own sort of junior associate classes. And he, you know, I'm not a dancer of the world. Let's put it that way. I am the worst dancer. But I just saw his strength and his commitment and his work ethic was brilliant. And then, yeah, he tried out for Tring, which is not far from us, about an hour from where we live, which is a very, very good dance school. Elmhurst, which is connected to the Royal Ballet, but in Birmingham, and then the Royal Ballet School, which is White Lodge in Richmond Park, which is from the Billy Elliot film, where he goes down to do that audition.
Uh-huh.
And he got through to the finals and got into all of them. And
oh my gosh.
So he's chosen White Lodge. They've taken 12 boys this year from 900 applicants, and he starts in September.
And how old is he?
He's 11.
Oh my God. You must be so proud. What an amazing achievement, and what, yeah, just so incredible to think about what might be ahead for him.
Yeah. And it's the nice thing is, you know, he doesn't enjoy the academic side of school terribly. He's more on the creative side, and, you know, it's quite sad to see sometimes the lack of creativity and how that's harnessed at school. You know, it's all about numbers and it's about measurement and it's about, you know, this exam and that exam, where, you know, to see someone so young be able to have that work ethic, for me is the really important one. And like I say, we don't push him. If he doesn't want to do it, he doesn't want to do it. And I'm not going to push him to do it. But his interest, and he absolutely loves to dance. It just alters his, you know, his mood, everything when he dances. So, you know, he's got a good chance. But, you know, like I say to him, the work really starts when you start going to school and you're working. You know, you've got to do your schoolwork, but you're probably dancing and training for, you know, 4 or 5 hours a day. But he's like, Dad, I will love it. Don't you worry.
Brilliant. That's so great. Ash, what do you cook at home for the family?
A lot of barbecuing. So big green egg, just really, my kids like really simple, bold things, lots of garlic, sort of, you know, lots of grilled vegetables, roast chicken. I mean, winter goes on here forever. So for 5-6 months of the year, it's quite hearty cooking on the weekends. You know, sort of shoulder of lamb and roast potatoes and, you know, that sort of stuff. And yeah, just a mixture of just normal home food, really, you know?
Love it. Well, it's been so incredible to have the opportunity to catch up with you. I really hope that the reopening of England and the whole of UK and Europe in general, I just hope it goes well. I hope it sticks. And yeah, I hope that the coffee and the cycling all goes brilliantly, and I can't wait to learn more about the restaurant. But thanks so much for your time today.
No worries. Well, good luck with reopening over there, and hopefully it won't be too long.
Yep, hope so too. Fingers crossed. Thank you.
This is Dirty Linen, and I'm Danny Vallant. We air the issues that the hospitality industry finds hard to talk about. We spend a week thrashing around each issue, hearing from different people with unique perspectives. We want to hear from you as well. If you have something that needs to be said about a topic, get in touch so we can include your perspective. Contact us at dirtylinen@deepintheweeds.com.au or hit us up on Insta @dirtylinenpodcast. We can't wait to hear from you. This.